Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Michael Footer.
And I'm Amanda Farrow.
On each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. This is GDC 2022 bonus episode number one, I Fought the Law, and the Law Won. It is the end of day one here at GDC 2022 in San Francisco. I am super excited that we are wrapping up the work part of our day with an amazing conversation with three amazing lawyers who we know well.
Our pocket full of lawyers.
We have binders full of lawyers.
Binders full of lawyers.
So with us, we have Brandon Huffman, friend of the show. Not your first time on the show.
Not your first rodeo
with Virtual Economy.
Brandon is founder of Odin Law and Media. We have Ryan Black from DLA Piper. Your current title is what?
I am, well, just a partner.
That guy.
You're just a partner? You're just a partner?
Just a partner. DLA Piper.
And we have Tyson Grattan from DLA Piper as well.
Hello.
The Canadians are outnumbering the Americans.
There are three
and
Canadians.
I'm so here for it.
And there are two Americans. Thank you guys for being here.
That seems about equal, though.
Based on exchange rate?
What?
On the exchange rate. Yeah, I like it.
Terrible.
I like it. We'll go with exchange rate, and he wasn't talking about intelligence.
Nikes.
Okay, well, that got off to a salty start.
What war were declared?
Oh, the war of 2022. So, for those of you who listen to the show, you know that we just love talking about legal stuff.
It's true.
We talk about specific legal stuff a lot of the times, but today we're going to be talking about some more general trend topics because we have this amazing brain trust of legal minds here. So we're going to
pockets full of lawyers.
Pockets full of lawyers. We are going to cover three topics real quickly. Obviously,
give me the topics real quick.
One of the big trends that we've been following on the show. Obviously, consolidation and all the mergers and acquisition that's going on.
And has been going on since last year, specifically.
I believe that we end the first quarter of 2022, we're already pacing well ahead of 2021. That doesn't even include the Microsoft-Activision thing, because that's just bananas. We're going to be talking about labor issues, obviously a topic that we cover on a regular basis. But here's one that we don't often talk about, because we're just... You know, sirens and stuff. We found a quiet room.
It's not really quiet. It's fine.
It's all right. San Francisco's a special place. We're going to talk about the challenges with play to earn. Obviously, we don't cover NFTs on the show. We don't usually cover blockchain on the show for a lot of reasons. Environmental impact, the grift, the stolen art, all of the stuff that goes along with that. But play to earn is something that we've been hearing a lot about.
We're seeing a lot of it here
at GDC. There are a lot of advertisers, a lot of sponsors that are involved. So let's dive in first, though, with consolidation in MMA. Obviously, gentlemen, we have seen this enormous trend towards consolidation. When do we start having a problem? Like, legally, are we now verging on the point where there are... Are we almost there? Are we running into a situation where we're going to see competition diminished in a meaningful way because of what's going on at the AAA level? Your thoughts?
It seems to me like despite the consolidation, like there's a lot of competition in the industry. So, for example, you know, Epic and Steam and GOG and all these things, and Sony and PlayStation and Nintendo. In fact, in my, 40 years of video game playing, I would say it's one of the most competitive landscapes I've seen. The problem, of course, is that the reach is so much bigger. Mm-hmm. So it's now a part of everyone's life. You know, when I was growing up and there was, 10 kids on my block playing video games, it mattered, if you were locked into one system or not.
Absolutely.
Now it's like everybody's playing games. You can have a very large market and still have a captive market.
I agree, and I, for what it's worth, I don't think that this is actually about consolidation of competition in Microsoft's eyes. I think it's more, or I guess in the general large publisher eyes. I think for a lot of the platforms especially, it's about shoring up subscription content from legacy content holders and getting it all under one under their subscription umbrella to build in value for a $9.99 or $15.99 a month or whatever it ends up being.
It's the catalog titles.
Correct.
Yeah, and that's something that we've talked about a ton on this show is the movement that catalog titles tend to have with a lot of publishers.
Now, one of the things that was really interesting was shortly after the Activision-Microsoft deal was announced, Microsoft came forward and said, look, we're looking to keep Call of Duty on all platforms. We're looking right. to ensure that these games still have the reach that they have. How much of a factor do you think that's going to be as regulators take a look at this deal and determine whether or not they're going to permit Microsoft to acquire Activision?
I have to imagine that the willingness to work with other platforms and license your content on other platforms is going to definitely play to their favor. That being said, I'd be kind of surprised if anything actually hinged on that. I think, in traditional kind of antitrust analysis, you kind of just look at what is the market defined as. You always have to start as what is the market, and then is there a cornering of that market? And in this case, if the market is video games, then, Call of Duty is it's a very, very large title, don't get me wrong, but it's a tiny blip of video games.
Mm-hmm.
If the market is first-person shooters coming out annually on platforms, then you're now looking at a smaller market of which Call of Duty is a bigger share. So I always think that, like, when you're looking at these things, it's always going to come down to that. And then the questions about things like, are you going to let other people play? That's if you're above that threshold. If you're above that anti-competitive threshold, that's when people are going to start, asking for things like that.
Yeah, so I'm not an antitrust expert by any stretch, but I will say I think from my understanding of how most cases get interpreted is that the real question is it bad for consumers? And I have to guess that if Microsoft started putting out Activision titles at $90 a title, where the rest of the market was still at 60 to sometimes 70, people would just stop buying them,
mm-hmm.
right?
It's
and
true.
So it wouldn't actually be, like, they're not forced into it.
Right, it's not, and I'll make the analogy here, because obviously the biggest antitrust conversation that we've had in this corner is about Epic and Apple and Epic and Google. And obviously the big conversation there is, what is the market? Was a big piece of the conversation. Is the market the App Store? Is the market mobile app stores? Is the market all video game storefronts?
Yeah, which if you're Tim Sweeney, in that case, the market was people who own iPhones.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's also just a matter of control of distribution channels. It's consolidation primarily in IP, which is something that we've seen in the film and television world for a decade, as all these different platforms are trying to fight with one another for eyeballs online and providing value to their subscribers. That's another thing I definitely look at. Again, same disclaimer as Brandon. I'm not an antitrust or competition lawyer, but what is that impact? And also got to remember that this is only one segment of the market. Like, it's as a consumer of video games as well as a video game lawyer, it's never been a better time, I think, to be a consumer of video games. Like, the amount of amazing titles and the amount of competition and new ideas that are sprouting up is seemingly endless, and there's great competition among lots and lots of developers out there. So
one of the things that I came across today when I was going through my inbox was an article from Seeking Alpha, where the author was talking about the potential of the Department of Justice in the United States blocking this acquisition based on the stock value being at least 20% under the $95 that they're promising per share upon closing the deal. Now, from a legal perspective, like, do you think that that holds water?
So I'm going to fully play the Canadian card here. The Department of Justice is terrifying to all
Canadian
lawyers.
It's so scary. It's so scary.
They're like the orange jumpsuits type people show up with cuffs and orange jumpsuits. See, Canada, regulators aren't really like that. But my experience in looking at M&A activity in the U.S. has been that they are very hands-off, even in very large deals. Now, granted, this is a very, very, very large deal, and it is the sort of deal that will definitely attract regulatory attention. But I just can't imagine that there isn't some deal mechanic. When we're doing deals, I will just say generally, I have to imagine that the people that papered the Microsoft Activision deal really know what they're doing. I have to imagine that they have clauses to deal with all sorts of regulatory hurdles that may come up. And this was never going to be a short process.
No.
This is going to be a very long process. But
the deal isn't set to close until literally next calendar year.
That's right. It'll likely be well into 2023. So there's lots of time to work things like that out. And the stock price will move lots from there. Generally, we would expect the market cap to stay around the offer price in
the public
market.
We looked at this right before we started recording. It's at $61 billion. The deal is $68.7
billion,
I believe.
$7 billion is a lot of money, but in terms of a premium on a publicly traded stock as a percentage, it's actually not that off from what we typically see.
Okay.
Yeah. I also just, as Ryan said, the people who made this deal almost certainly know what they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course.
So, and almost certainly had hundreds of people involved in the papering of this deal, from tax and finance people to lawyers and et cetera. But whenever you announce a deal this size and you know there's a delay before it closes, you build in all kinds of contingencies into that deal document. I would be surprised if the variance in the stock price wasn't accounted for in some way.
Sure. Sure.
Well, sometimes he ratchets and collars, so like there'll be like steps down a ladder where
mm-hmm.
like between this band you might have a price difference. There might be premiums available if they can maintain the stock price at a certain level. There might be a whole
okay.
bunch of
yeah,
mechanics.
There could be purchase price adjustments for various contingencies that once those are taken into account, the variance actually isn't that much. We don't know what the deal actually says.
So the one question that I have as we look at this consolidation, obviously we brought up subscriptions. Now, it's early in the week. Sony is rumored to be announcing their own subscription service, their answer to Game Pass. At some point in March, it felt like Sony has typically done big GDC announcements. That's where PSVR was announced. That's where PSVR was shown for the first time to the media. So like, it would not surprise me if later this week we hear that Sony is doing their own subscription program. Nintendo
they
runs
already
its own
have
ones.
Their own subscription program. It's something we've talked about a ton.
You know what
they
I mean.
They were first to market.
Right. So they have PlayStation Now.
Yes, Now.
Yeah.
But they don't know that. So
they just put it on a shelf and they're like, don't worry about it.
It's fine.
It's fine here.
It's still a very large panel on all of their home screens.
I know, but no one
they put no
it.
Marketing money behind it though. It's so weird. So they woke up and realized, oh yeah, we had this thing. We were first to market.
So now
should
they'll,
we
now
polish
they'll
it?
Announce it?
Now
yeah,
well they're gonna 100%. Announce they're gonna retool it in such a way so where it's gonna combine
the cloud.
Based on reporting. There's gonna be the cloud element. There, which existed. I mean, PlayStation Now was originally a cloud-based service, and
yeah.
It was originally a rental service when it was in beta. So you it was a per-game rental service, and then they went to the all-in subscription thing, which is good for them because they avoided Google Stadia's problems before Google Stadia created its own problems.
Another GDC announcement.
Yeah. Oh God, that was 3 years ago at the last GDC, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah.
Good Lord, here we are again.
Yep.
So my question is, how much do you think subscriptions are going to factor into the conversation around regulation? Because it seems like we are pivoting the industry in a way that has been done before in music and television and movies. But pivoting this industry right now at its scale, at this point, does subscription factor into the conversation when you're talking about first parties buying up not just studios, but publishers? And gobbling up big publishers.
Does it factor into the regulatory discussion?
Yeah.
It definitely factors into the purchasing. Like, we know why they're doing these deals.
Oh, sure.
I mean,
absolutely.
Like, this is 100% about content. You know, the regulators, I think, are going to see that there's a lot of... I would imagine that the video game people that are trying to push through these types of deals are going to say, we're not competing against Xbox and, you know, Sony's not competing against Xbox and Nintendo. We're competing against Netflix and Hulu and...
Which is what Netflix has already said.
And there is this idea that we've kind of saturated people, and it's becoming clear that it's harder and harder to get people to part with $80 or $90 a pop as opposed to $16 a month or $20 a month. It's just
it's more inclusive as well. I mean, it's an approachable model that ensures that gaming is something that is accessible for people that don't have tons of money, that they're just able to have a subscription service and their kids can play it.
Right.
And you know, the whole family's good.
Well,
to
but
go.
Then ironically, you are losing the ownership physical aspect
that's
of games, right?
Saying.
So there was, like, you know, didn't have a lot of cash growing up, but I got lots of hand-me-down games.
Well,
no, that's true.
And not only that, I was, the other day, so my son and I play, you know, we have our Xbox Arcade that we, you know, we download, or we don't even download. We specifically look at cloud gaming things, so we don't have to wait for downloads.
Mm-hmm.
But so we sit and we play it, but I was telling him the other day, like, hey, before you were born, there used to be a place that we drove to, and you could pay like $5 and take a game home and then return it later when you were done with it.
And, whoa!
It's called GameStop, bro.
Oh, super awkward.
Yeah, so, but like, Blockbuster existed
right.
because physical was the thing.
Yeah.
And now, like, $15 a month is probably what we would have spent on rentals.
At least.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, that's a pretty conservative number.
Yeah.
Well, how about, it's what I as a parent would spend on my kids' rentals.
No, fair enough.
You know what, we are coming at this from a different perspective now, aren't we?
Yeah.
A
little bit.
But, yeah, so I think that the removal of the physical side of it, and then, you know, you can't borrow your neighbor's copy anymore, because
mm-hmm.
you can't borrow a copy of a subscription.
Right.
And we'll see how long it takes them to implement crackdowns on password sharing.
Well, Netflix is rumored to be preparing some kind of surcharge if you share with people outside your home. Spotify requires you to attest that everybody who is on your family account is in your home.
Is in your home.
That's going to be interesting when Grace goes to college this fall.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I hadn't even... Oh,
Netflix,
I don't know if it's
Spotify.
Just Canada or if it's in the U.S., but you actually really have to attest to the family plan. Like,
you did. Spotify, you
I
do,
feel
yeah.
Like, yeah. I feel like I had to, like, show, like, a driver's license.
I mean, technically, she will be still a resident of our home.
Right.
Like, her permanent address will be our house. So
as opposed to her dorm room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll have to set her up with a VPN to log into home.
Oh, you know I will do that. Yeah. You know Mama will do that.
So I think the other thing that's going for them when you look at the subscription side of things is that right now there's the, especially on the Microsoft side, there's the era of the altruism. They have created this messaging around Game Pass, as Amanda said, where it's, I mean, we've said it multiple times, it's the best value in gaming.
Sure. And I mean, as much as we talk about altruism in corporations, that's not what this is.
No, it's not.
It's just that the corporate strategy has aligned with consumer sentiment in a really wonderful way,
mm-hmm.
which is great, but it doesn't, it has nothing to do with anything other than where their values are today.
Well, and think about what Microsoft got in trouble for with the announcement of the Xbox One. I don't know if you remember, they were
I remember.
List. Look at all of the things that they were pushing for. They are all part of Xbox Games Pass. Almost every single one of those features, not being able to trade games, having a subscription that's always online, all these sorts of things that the entire industry rebelled against, or sorry, the entire consumer base rebelled
yes.
against, is now literally part of the service that everyone loves.
In 2013, after that announcement, before it came out, I wrote a piece when I was a Game Informer that said Microsoft can still realize its dream of a digital future. And it was, I refer back to it every once in a while because, like, I knew what I was talking about. Yeah. And they were just ahead of their time, and the messaging around it was so bad.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of reasons why that messaging was really bad, and we've talked about it a lot on this podcast.
Yeah, those people are no longer at Microsoft.
No.
My question is, this is something we've also talked about, where Game Pass and other subscription services like it are only good while they're good. For consumers, I mean. And
not just for consumers, though, but for developers.
Right, for developers, right?
Because as far
yeah.
as we know, you know, between ID at Xbox and the Game Pass, you know, the way that they compensate developers, it is still good for developers, from what we understand. It may not stay that way. It may change quite a bit. And then what do we have? This comes back to consolidation all
yes.
over again. Is the reason why people are so spooked is because the people at the top can change entirely. Leadership can change. Satya Nadella can leave.
Phil
can leave.
Yeah.
The entire Xbox executive team, like Sarah Bond, everybody could leave. And then they're left with this hollow husk that has a shit ton of power.
I think the counterpoint to that is Atari or Sega.
Yeah,
right?
Agree.
Like consoles
yeah.
and platforms can also leave.
Sure,
like
sure.
if the leadership gets to a point where the developers aren't happy putting content on it, developers won't put content on it.
Yeah.
True. I think the challenge and the interesting thing here is we're at this moment where the console no longer, the hardware no longer defines the platform.
It doesn't, because it comes down to that ecosystem where there's a ton of interoperability.
And people are still putting music on Spotify, even though everybody says that...
Spotify is the worst deal for music artists.
Yeah,
I think the difference here, though, from Spotify is that Spotify has... Like, if you're the musician, Spotify has the ears.
Oh,
right.
Sure.
Right? You're talking about a shift that would hurt both developers and consumers. And I think that if you lose the consumers, developers aren't going to go there anymore, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
No, we end up with the Stadia problem again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who was that even for?
As a consumer, it's very easy to shift platforms. And I think you do have to look at what's happened in the film and TV world, the subscription services, and how that works for producers. Like, television producers, movie producers, they don't know how shows are doing on Netflix. They don't know any details, but they get paid their license fee, and goodbye. And thanks for the 10-year license.
And there's no metrics.
There's no data. Nothing's ever released. No data is released, or you fight tooth and nail to try to get any of it. And so it's pretty difficult.
Well, and you read stories from Netflix of things that are critically acclaimed, have these massive online audiences, but get canceled. They get canceled because the algorithm internally says, this is why we need to reprioritize other content.
Well, this is what developers are worried about, right? And it hasn't come to pass, but people are worried that subscription programs will eventually only incentivize a narrow type of game. It'll be recurrent revenue. It'll be games that you can keep playing over a long period of time, even if there isn't recurrent revenue.
As opposed to what it is now, which is a combination of things, including... you know, non-violent indie games and family-friendly games. Like, I mean, Microsoft doesn't have a ton going for it right now when it comes to family-friendly gaming. And, I mean, the Activision Blizzard, you know, acquisition could be huge for that because of the entire catalog that they'd have access to.
Very true. Yeah. The other thing is these subscription services are an absolute money pit. When you look at how much money Netflix and Amazon are pouring into their services, trying to compete with one another, it's not a for sure thing.
So, by contrast, Disney prints money with its subscription service because
it had already had content. But when you're an Amazon, for example, and you're trying to fight tooth and nail to create a bunch of new IP, you've seen difficulties in some of their shows.
I like how Disney's laughing. It's like, you thought the Disney Vault sucked. Guess what? Here we go.
Yeah, no, never doubt the mouse.
I want to pivot to labor issues, which obviously we're going to be talking about some of the same companies here, because Activision, obviously the big thing that opened the door for Microsoft to approach them, even just days after the problems started emerging, the fact that Activision has enormous labor issues, huge culture that has bred toxicity.
And not just in one of their studios, but in probably all of them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then you have multiple forced errors. You've got Jen O'Neill, who was in her role as co-head of Blizzard for 3 months, and then it was outed that she couldn't even get the same parity with Mike Ibarra, who was the other co-head.
And considering how long she was at Activision Blizzard,
she was the head of Vicarious
She was the head of Vicarious Visions, and she couldn't get paid what her male counterpart, who'd only just joined Activision, y'all.
And then we got, of course, Ubisoft Paradox. The stories that came out this weekend from People Make Games, where you had some small studios that were identified.
Oh, absolutely. They're terrifying.
Yep. Sony, even now.
Which we heard whispers of for years.
Sure. There was one person who filed a suit that they're seeking class action for. And then Sony, argued that, their case was just, they haven't really substantiated anything. And then 8 more women stepped forward and said, here are our experiences. I guess the question I have for all of you on the legal front is, what are the things that we are going to start seeing? Are we going to start seeing huge settlements? Are we going to see changes? Are we going to see any kind of regulation, do you think?
Are we finally going to see the end of arbitration clauses in employment contracts?
The thing. These are all afoot. And I don't want to, I certainly wouldn't defend any bad actors, but I think that these stories that you're talking about reflect a larger problem in the industry, and that they are not
absolutely
isolated to those studios.
I would go a step farther and say that they reflect a larger problem
in the world.
In the world.
Yeah. You know, we deal with this. I'll take a step back, if you don't mind, and just talk a little bit about the legal industry. The legal industry is another industry that is dominated by straight white men. There's, you know, power structures that have existed for a long time, and no one company can fix the industry, just like no one industry can fix society.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we are seeing a gradual change. Like, so for example, yes, you hear about stories like that, but you also see, you know, NVIDIA being run by a very powerful woman that you know, is doing, by all accounts, running a pretty good ship there. And what I guess what I'm saying is that, like, over time, I think we'll see these problems continue to come out. And the solutions can't be focused on the video game industry. There is a willingness to talk about it in the video game industry online and in social circles that there isn't in other industries. But I can tell you, you know, having dealt in other technology companies, like, salespeople are, like, just, like, rampantly sexist and racist and misogynist and all sorts of things. And, you know, like, dentists and doctors, like, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And I think a big difference is there's a lot of air being given to it in the video game industry. Because people come into video games usually out of a joy of making things that give people fun. And when you hear about these things...
We're all a bunch of misfits.
Yeah, and when you hear about these things, it's like... How could you create something joyful like a video game and subject women to this or you know, whatever the story
like
is?
Like entire teams that are completely beaten down by one or two really desperately problematic people. And it has nothing to do with big studios versus little studios versus in North America or anywhere else. It is a rampant problem that comes down to abuses of power that people that are being put into management positions are not given the proper training. They're not given, you know, any other career path other than, okay, well, you are a really good engineer. Now you're going to manage engineers. And it's like, that's not the career path here, people.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
How old is L.A. Noire?
I don't know.
It's more than a decade at this point, right? It was PS3 and Xbox 360.
Oh, yeah. It was, how old's Gabriel? Gabriel's almost 11.
Yeah.
Benchmarking with kids.
Yeah. No, I'm benchmarking because I played it when I was pregnant. So it must have been 2010.
Okay.
I think.
So it's a game that's 12 years old. And the reason I bring it up is because Studio Bandai, which was the studio behind it, all of the stories that we are hearing today, we heard
years
back
ago.
Then. Studio Bandai was one. And that was one story that managed to get out.
Yeah.
And of course, how much has changed? Just the fact that people are willing to talk about it and the stories are getting out and
well,
they're getting
it,
the air.
It's a willing media, though. I think that's the other part of it, is that the media is actually willing to listen and give people voices that felt like they had no power and they had no way to hold their abusers accountable.
Absolutely. The air and the pressure will have its effect, and it will take time. You think about this in other industries and musicians and other situations where you did hear about bad behavior and we all knew about it, the public knew about it. It takes time, and then eventually it cascaded over. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that you'll see the same thing here. And I think the air and the pressure is obviously good. We need it. And that's the only way that these types of changes are going to happen is by people giving it air, the media reporting on it, and just keep that going. And I think that the video game industry is lucky that it is so predominant that these conversations are happening, because I agree with everybody here that it's not just the video game industry. It's basically
it's
every industry. But I guess one good thing about the video game industry is that the conversation is very present and very loud. And it's only getting louder and more present, which is great. And that's the only way these things are going to get pressured to change.
To your specific legal question about, do we think mandatory arbitration clauses will go away?
Yes.
I actually think probably in the next decade they will.
Yay!
I think that for the United States, I should say. I can't speak for any other jurisdiction, right? I can't really speak for the entirety of the United States.
What's Canada going to do, guys?
But I do think that
remember
there is
that labor issues in Canada are way different.
Yeah. Well, I do think that there's a trend in the U.S., sort of a pendulum swing back towards workers and
unionization.
And unionization will be part of that that will accelerate the pendulum, right? And I think that, you know, a lot of that will depend on midterm elections and then, you know.
Are you saying this all comes down to politics?
Yes.
God damn it.
Unfortunately, yes. Like, you know, the policies you get put the policies that get put in place are reflective of the people in charge, right? So I think right now you're seeing, you know, you've already seen some news from the White House about non-competes and non-solicits. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're likely to see more of that sort of stuff if there is a liberal swing in the midterm elections that empowers what will otherwise be a lame duck president.
And even in Canada, we've got, you know, a relatively, for Canadian standards, right-wing government in Ontario. They've just passed a blanket ban on non-competes. And for example, the right to disconnect. That's going to be another movement that we're going to see in the video game industry for crunch. They are now requiring companies to have a policy on allowing people to actually take their time off.
Yeah.
Like away from work. And so...
I don't know how I feel about that as an employer.
Yeah, no.
Wow. Here's the door, bro.
It's, but in that case, you know, you have, again, like not the most left-wing government in the world, but responding to a real problem that people are saying they're having in the pandemic.
Okay, but at the same time, as the Canadians in the room, our right wing is still somewhat left wing here.
For now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, look,
I don't know.
Yeah.
What about that trucker convoy?
Oh, I don't want to talk
I
about
thought
that.
We were going to avoid
no!
talking about the trucker convoy.
No, we're not talking convoy. About it. We do not talk about Bruno. That is Bruno.
Oh, no.
So embarrassing.
We
fucking embarrassing.
It is embarrassing.
It's real bad.
In typical Canadian fashion, we are sorry.
Yeah.
We are sorry.
You know, we're the ones who should be sorry. There were a bunch of Americans crossing the border.
I will also say the American equivalent trucker convoy was quite disappointing by comparison. Like, it just.
But I always think it's worse to be a follower than a leader.
That's fair. But I'm not even saying, like, from a policy perspective. Just like, how were they so bad at organizing and then also articulating any sort of message whatsoever?
I'll give you a hint, they're not the smartest.
Yeah. The sophomore release is always the hardest.
Oh, this is the shittiest band ever. Oh, no.
All right, so that's the end of this song.
Yes. Yeah, there it is.
That's the end of that.
So, I mean, in terms of, like, I want to just revisit one question I had. Do you think that we're going to see anything sizable in terms of settlements? Obviously, the DFEH and the EEOC are still in a pissing match. DFEH is not winning that battle right now. But if the EEOC has their way, was it $18 million is going
to
be the settlement fund for Activision?
Now, for what it's worth, that is a large settlement. It seems like a small settlement because of the scope of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
also the size of the market cap for the problematic
company. How many
company.
Years of salary $18 million is.
That's a lot of money
for
a settlement in this context. That is a lot of money.
In Canada, we think of things in terms of in lieu of notice or in lieu of working time. So,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, if you make $200,000 a year and you get a $500,000 payout from your employer, that's basically like getting paid 2.5 years of labor. That's a very large settlement by Canadians.
Sure, but if people are getting $500,000 settlements, that's 36 people, right?
Yeah.
At $18 million, my math is.
I don't math.
Yeah, no, and.
You have lawyers in the room and you want us to
so,
math.
So,
oh, wait, am I the math guy?
I don't know.
Literally the one with the MBA.
So I don't know how many employees are in this, like, class,
and
right?
Good, and that's what has not been defined. And also, it's not just current employees. It's former employees as well. And I think the question that... I think the tough thing here is... Is this kind of settlement supposed to be restorative? And if it is supposed
to
be restorative, how do you make whole someone who was drummed out of the industry because of these experiences in multiple studios, even potentially within the same publisher? Someone who took their own life. Obviously, Activision has now been sued for wrongful death by the parents of... I'm sorry, I do not remember her name. We covered her on the last episode before... before we went on hiatus for the move, you know, and obviously they just found out about the details of it from the DFEH filing.
Can you imagine being a parent and that
and seeing
being
your name, seeing your child's name in the
She wasn't actually named in the DFEH suit, but obviously she was the one. But also finding out all these horrific details about the events that led up to that and the potential of a cover up that happened where. You know, he left his key card in her room. the weird text messages that went back and forth between them, and that the employer potentially covered it up.
So her name, and I will not forget this again, her name was Carrie Moynihan.
Thank you. So, I mean, obviously, you know, how are these settlements designed to be restorative? And if so, how do we get there? How do we get to the point where is restorative
it's
justice?
It's hard to talk, you know, in the specific. Again, I don't know the details of that case at all. But to be, you know, bluntly lawyerly for a second, settlements are actually not designed to be anything other than ending the litigation or ending the matter.
Okay.
And it's they often do contain, for example, when a government agency settles with someone, they will often say in the press release that, you know, this money is for this or this money is for this.
No one admits
but
any
ultimately,
wrongdoing.
But when you read the settlement document, there'll be things about not admitting any wrongdoing and that sort of thing. And so settlements are actually, you know, in terms of justice, if justice is your end goal, settlements are not a route to justice, generally speaking. They're a route to ending the dispute, bringing peace to a matter. In fact, they're encouraged. Canada, you know, again, coming to this from a Canadian perspective, Canada's legal system and litigation system is set up to design to encourage settlement. It is set up, we have so few cases that actually get to end resolution when you look at the total net number of cases filed.
I think it's very similar in the United States.
I don't know that it's designed that way, but it
is
very
similar. It ends up being that way, but our cases are, our system is designed that way. And the reason for it is that they view kind of closure as almost more important in the civil context than justice. We don't see large civil damages, for example. We don't see large punitive damages. It is not designed for justice. Whereas I see in the U.S., and this is just an outsider's perspective, I see, particularly with civil jury trials, I see that there is a restorative and justice element to a lot of these decisions. And then I see the judges trying to claw some of that back and say, no, we need to have some semblance of order in our judgments. So, you know, I personally think that if you're trying to achieve justice, a settlement is more about peace.
Got it. That's a great answer.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
And there's definitely one party that's maybe thinking about justice and being made whole and being restored, and the other party is strictly thinking, what do I need to pay to make this go away?
Yeah.
Well, and in this context, it's important to remember that, like, the plaintiff, the person pursuing the money, is not any of the victims of the behavior. It's a state agency or a federal agency pursuing a claim on behalf of victims.
Right.
So it's, and I don't mean this in any negative way, it's bureaucrats who are doing a job, and their job is to reach a result, and that result might not be one that makes the victims happy.
Got it. That's an ugly truth, but it is
an important piece of the conversation that you and I were missing.
Yeah, well, that's why we're having this conversation.
It's almost like we're not experts on everything.
We're not.
Well, and I hope no one thinks that we're experts on anything either.
No, we just picked these guys off the street.
So, just to be very clear, this episode does not constitute legal advice.
You're going to put that in the intro, right?
Yes.
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 Don't worry
Absolutely.
About it. We got this.
Do you have to include that this is not attorney advertising?
Oh, yeah, say that in the intro.
Okay.
Okay,
our lawyers are sitting at this table giving us legal advice. Yeah. But they're our lawyers. It's okay.
All right.
Last topic we wanted to cover because, you know, you walk around GDC. Obviously, the expo floor hasn't opened yet, but some of the advertising is up. We've seen a lot of stuff around play to earn.
Now, sir, like, before we get into play to earn, let's define it.
Wait, are we doing the...
No, we're not doing it. Because I don't have the script in front of me. We're not doing it.
We're not doing
enough.
A slurry
we're not,
of
ew,
information.
Gross. Just...
Slurp it up.
Does anybody want to, like, just remove him?
Can you do a Lin-Manuel Miranda-style expositional rap?
I probably could, but I'd need time to put it together. You should hear the songs that I sing at home.
Oh, God. No, you shouldn't. He uses his voice, his beautiful voice, for great evil. Great evil.
So,
all of our children will attest to this.
So, real quickly, Play to Earn is designed so that players of the game can cash in, engage in the game, and then have some kind of financial remuneration as a result of their engaging in the game. Now, we call that work.
Yeah, we do. But also, are they being paid in company scrip?
That's Roblox. We are not talking
about
Roblox
today. Okay, I'm just making sure.
That's,
just making sure.
That bull shrimp is a very different topic.
No Roblox.
Have you done an episode on that?
Yes. We've done a lot of talking about Roblox, and there was the...
I did a lot of writing about Roblox.
That was also People Make Games, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That had both of those really great exposés on what was going on at Roblox. Yeah, we've talked about that a lot. And Manda, of course, with the parenting angle, has done a lot of research, a lot of interviews around Roblox. But Play to Earn, the concept here is that there is a group of companies, a group of investors especially, who think that gamers want to come home after a long day of work and play a game so that they can earn money or potentially just quit their jobs and earn money. Now, we talked about this before we started recording. Axie Infinity is one of these games where you have people who purchase these axes, which are kind of like Pokemon, but then they can loan them or rent them to other people so that they can play with them, and they get a piece of the proceeds.
Wait,
it's sharecropping. It's
hold
sharecropping.
On a second.
I thought you
it's
almost
like
said
Neopets.
The word slave. It sounded like you. It sounded like you were. You said people.
As my lawyer, I would never say something like that. Because
oh,
that might incriminate me in being a complete dumbass. No. I mean, it feels like sharecropping, right? Where you own this thing, and then you loan it out to somebody else to work.
I think own is doing a lot of work there.
Oh, own is doing
a lot
of work.
It's a big
list. That's the big NFT conversation. So, we're not talking about Bruno Earn and NFT.
It's almost difficult to talk about Play to Earn without talking about
it. We kind of have to, because that's the big piece. You own this digital, again, this big air quotes around own, this digital artifact, this item that you then loan out to other people, potentially in the case of Axie Infinity. They play
it's
with
like
it.
A
they pay you.
Marketing scheme.
It does. It feels like an MLM, right?
Well, look, for a long time, people have recognized that when you're trying to sell something, incentivizing behavior with some sort of a reward system works. We see points programs for the hotel we're staying at, for all sorts of things. And it's this idea that the more that you use our service, the more rewards you get. So the idea of rewarding your consumers or rewarding your most valuable players or rewarding people who spend in the ecosystem, or if you're an ad-based game who spend time in the ecosystem, this is not a new concept in retail.
No.
But the angles on this, on giving people, you know, freedom from their job or a real sustainable income or anything like that, like it ignores the fact that these industries kind of exist to make money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I, you know, very rarely do you hear people earning a living selling their air miles or whatever it is.
Right.
This is more designed to be a perk. And truthfully, our systems of law in this area have been designed for semi-non-valuable perks. And I think the biggest trouble in these areas are going to be is that the way that these things are being marketed as, this is real value. We are giving you real value for playing our game. And Brandon Tyson and I could spend an entire podcast talking about all the problems with allowing people to earn value in games from a legal perspective.
All right, so let's root this in the loot box conversation, because this is a place where we've had this debate about value and
what
yeah.
it actually
real world
means.
Absolutely. Well, how you described play to earn is basically, at least our Canadian definition of gambling, right?
Yep.
People are paying consideration. They play a game. They receive something of value. And the way we've been kind of getting out of it, to take back the loot box thing, is that something of value that they receive, we make the argument that it's not something of value because it's a virtual good that you can't sell, you can't cash out. You only can use it within our little ecosystem, and that's it. And so that, by kind of like the fire triangle, is how I think about it. If you don't have one of the three elements, then it's not gambling. So that's fine. So that's why loot box is available in Canada. But this general idea, and that's one of the biggest hurdles I have to figure out, is how do we deal with this where people are paying money to play a game to receive some kind of valuable consideration. In this case, literally money.
Well, a lot of them are free to play.
Yeah. Well.
So they're providing, not in Canada. The law is about providing consideration,
not necessarily
paying.
Money.
That's what I was
like
hoping. That was the answer I was trying to elicit by saying that, right?
Difference.
Because I knew the second you said people are paying, somebody listening is going to go, "Well, what if I don't pay?"
Yeah.
So I have two questions that have popped up as a result of these responses, because that was really interesting. One, is the Steam Marketplace allowed in Canada?
It is.
Yeah.
All right. So you can get a Counter-Strike Go knife that you can turn around and sell for real money on the marketplace. But that money stays in your Steam wallet, right? You can't actually
cash that out
through Steam's system, correct?
I'm actually not familiar with how the Steam system works, being honest. I don't play any games.
I think it stays in your wallet.
I think it just stays in your Steam wallet. It doesn't go anywhere.
But you can buy other games for it.
Yeah, they want to keep that money in the ecosystem,
right?
It's like their version of Scrip.
Right.
But I think that look, when you're paying Steam people, box. I just want to even take a back step from loot boxes and gambling and all sorts of stuff. When you're paying people money, you're all of a sudden thinking about things like, how do I report it on their taxes?
Sure.
How do I know that this is not some money laundering scheme? How do I know that I'm not paying someone on sanctions?
Exactly.
So companies shouldn't like, and this is where I get worried, is that a lot of the movement in this industry is from new entrants who have not been around as long as Valve or Microsoft or Sony and don't understand how freaking hard it is to pay 50 states players money. It's very, very hard.
Think about how long it took everybody to catch up with online purchases and there being automatic taxing on.
Well, even if you take it out of the game development or game playing context, and you look at something like Twitch, and like how long did it take Twitch to formalize a program where they had a legit know your customer system,
mm-hmm.
and a legit 1099 system to
distribute
taxes.
Yeah.
And think about all the steps you have to do there. You have to buy the bits, and you have to convert the bits into diamonds, and then you gift the diamonds. And like it's set up because it's very complicated to do.
Yeah. Now, in some ways, it might end up being like a money services business, and now you're dealing with financial services regulations. Transferring money across borders is extremely difficult. There's a reason why literally every business uses a third-party payment processor.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, and so if you are, not to name any names in the industry, right, but if you are a developer who's developing a game that is a play-to-earn game that uses your own blockchain, you are in charge of that system from top to bottom, and you can't pass the buck
to anyone.
Which is why most of them want to use something like Ethereum, which is extremely environmentally.
But even if you're using something like Ethereum, if you are coding the system that tells Ethereum what to write onto the Ethereum
blockchain, you are still responsible.
You're still
for
owning
it.
That process. What Tyson is saying is that most of our clients that do any sort of payment processing use companies that are set up for payment processing.
Sure.
And regulated
for payment processing.
Like Exola is a big one.
Like Exola or PayPal or
mm-hmm.
Stripe
yep.
or any
sure.
of these companies that have gone through huge
Square.
Amounts of steps to make
mm-hmm.
sure that they are doing everything they need to do under every government that they operate under.
Sure.
Also, a lot of those payment processors don't operate worldwide.
Right.
Because every country has different regulations and some countries won't allow them to operate.
Sure.
And once you put it into a crypto world, borders don't exist anymore.
Right.
Ryan mentioned sanctioned individuals. I can tell you from experience that I have had clients who have, you know, situations where they come to me and they say, hey, we've got this developer in fill in the blank, and it's a country subject to sanctions.
Hmm.
And I say, why? Don't have that developer. Because you can't, like, they say, well, how do we pay him? And I say, you don't pay him, right?
And, you cannot currently send that kind of money to Russia.
Well,
you
can pay people in Russia. Like, you have to look at the sanctions very specifically because
mm-hmm.
the sanctions don't apply universally to every individual.
Okay.
But my point is, like, it's a lot simpler to just find a developer who's not subject to sanctions, right?
Yeah, not having to deal with it.
And it's such a bummer, too. I mean, like, even from a cultural perspective, being stuck in this world of, listen, that person probably did nothing wrong. They just live in the wrong country.
Well, but I guess, to bring it back into this context, right, if you have a play-to-earn game, and suddenly you have a bunch of sanctioned individuals in Russia playing your game.
Because they can't make money doing anything else right now.
And the value of their currency has...
A
country subject to severe sanctions, the value of their currency falls to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And these sanctioned individuals can play your game because you don't have any know-your-customer stuff. You have no regime to defend against this. And suddenly you're sending a bunch of money. You don't call it money. You call it, I don't know, whatever you call your token.
Yeah.
You're sending a bunch of money overseas to people who are subject to sanctions, which puts you in direct violation of U.S. and international law in a, like, criminal way.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's ugly.
Yeah.
That's
just
ugly.
Light treason.
Just,
just a lightly treasonous.
A little bit of treason. You know, between friends.
The other thing, and something Brandon said that maybe think about it, is the walled, when you're paying in a walled garden cryptocurrency, is you have to be thinking about security slots too. And that's
another
layer. If you're basically paying people in some token that has some value that's dependent on how well your game or platform or business does, guess what?
That's
a definition
of security.
Yeah.
So you better, it's fraught.
Well, and you lure people in with this idea, and you said earlier we call that a job, right? Or sharecropping, right?
Sure.
Like people, you lure people in with the promise of do this thing for a certain amount of time and you will get paid a certain amount. Kind of starts to look like a job, right? But then also, you know, what you're getting paid is something that is flexible in value.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's probably some labor protection and consumer protection that will come into play eventually.
Amazingly, we have now circled back to Roblox.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, like, Roblox is a slightly different system, right? But it has some of these issues.
It does.
Yeah.
It has a number of
issues. It has the labor issues. It has the company script issue. It's got
a cash out.
It's got a cash out. Not for everybody.
It's not a great cash out, but it does exist.
It's called DevEx.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
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 It's got flexible currency exchange
mm-hmm.
rates. Yeah.
Yep.
No, it's got a lot of this. Yeah. Not on the blockchain.
No, it's
yet.
Not yet.
That's a big old yet.
Oh, man. Like, that's a whole separate conversation. But we're going to wrap up here. This has been an amazing conversation.
I learned so much.
Yay.
Thank you. I love learning things.
Although, I do, before we close, because I would be remiss, you brought up gambling.
Mm.
And for those of you who are listening, who are American or who don't understand the way gambling is handled in different countries, there's a very interesting thing that happens in Canada around gambling.
I talked about this literally on our
show. You have talked
about
this, and Ryan and I talked about it for the Game Dev Budgeting Handbook. And it is the idea of a skill test.
Yes.
Correct. Yes.
So in Canada,
like
yes.
Like roll up the rim.
In Canada, when you are all used to seeing the small print on every contest that you run. In Canada, our small print has one extra term. That says there must be a skill testing element. And the skill testing element must be done without mathematical aid. And the skill testing element must be done usually with some controlled environment. And the idea is to turn the game from a game of pure chance into a game of mixed skill and chance.
Exactly.
And so it needs to be a true element of skill. And the reason you do this is because games of skill and games of mixed skill and chance are less regulated, not unregulated, but less regulated than games of pure chance.
Well, yeah, it's basically a lottery. If you're giving away things for free on the basis of chance that something has value, it's a lottery. You need a license to it.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's literally the reason. And it's fraud. It's so hard. Like, we've had clients that, somebody wins a prize and they're so excited. They show up to collect their prize. They can't answer
the question.
They
can't answer the darn math question.
Calling us like, what do we do? It's like, like it's
how many chances do you get?
Also,
you get one chance.
Like
what kind of question?
So
it's actually quite.
There is one approved question in our case law, because again, Canada has no case law because nobody brings a case to decision. There's one approved question, which is four operation three digit mathematical question. So three digits with four operations.
Yeah.
So it's actually hard. It's hard to do in your head. Like, I don't think I could do it.
No, I have to sit there on a piece of paper.
Does it have to be order of operations?
Oh, that one was not order of operations.
Okay.
No,
so we have seen contests run with the 1 + 1 = blank, or welcome to this, every 4 years sporting event. What is the answer to this mathematical question that happens to be the year of this sporting event? Like, we have seen these things, but the only approved one in court is a very difficult math question.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of, like, I feel like a four operation, three number question is the kind of thing you see posted to LinkedIn or Facebook with like 30 wrong answers.
It's pretty hard. It's like, what's 245 divided by 122 plus, 255 minus 983? You have 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Holy shit!
Like, yeah, we don't mess around in Canada.
Yeah, so
Monopoly and McDonald's.
There's no guidance on whether it's time.
While we do not advise our clients to do this, pretty much people just they don't structure it. They don't actually follow through with things exactly fully.
They are very friendly.
Roll up the rim, Monopoly at McDonald's. They don't do that.
So it's very clearly the loophole.
Yeah, because but the hilarious comparison to try to figure out, it's like, hey, well, that was one approved test. What would be an easier test, since that's only one case? The actual literal case that talks about this is about turkey shooting. Like, that, the cases are so old. It was where turkey shoot, where literally someone shoots a turkey, a live turkey.
Those still happen in the U.S.
For a prize. Okay, sorry. Well, I'm sorry about the cultural
difference. North Carolina's like a different country.
They still do possum drops in my state.
But they court found that
so many
when you're
questions.
Within, like, it was like 10 feet or something. That's too close. Literally anybody can do it. It's not skillful to shoot a turkey from 10 feet. It has to be whatever feet it was. It's like 60 feet or 35 feet or something like that.
So we have case law about how
far, case law that we're
how far
to
you can shoot a turkey
to,
for it to be
to answer
true
your question
skill.
About what should be a proper skill testing question. It's like, well, how far away do you have to be from the turkey?
Is the turkey allowed to move? Like, a moving target, even 10 feet is still a moving target.
Yeah, that's a good... You know,
does
the
turkey...
I think these turkeys were... unfortunately restrained.
So here's my question. If I go get a butterball, does that count?
You know what? I feel like we've gone a little off the rails.
As we always
do.
Like a turkey.
Like a turkey.
This is important Canadian history.
I'm so glad I brought this up.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So gambling law is very fun. Interesting.
And our gaming, true video game clients run into it all the time in this new economy that we have, where people are trying to attract eyeballs, incentivize play, reward their players. We run against, I'm sure as Brandon does in the US, we run against gambling and gaming laws every day.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming, because this is the way I typically handle this, you keep them on one side of those laws instead of telling them how to navigate into them.
Yeah, because it's virtually impossible in Canada to get a license to do any sort of commercial gaming, we teach them, we tell our clients how to stay out of gaming.
That's provincial.
It's provincial, except for Ontario now. Ontario.
Yeah. Well, it's a federal criminal code, and the criminal code delegates the ability to license certain types of gaming, to the provinces.
For the Americans, provincial is like... state by state.
Yes.
Oh, that we have to explain that makes me so sad.
And it's
except
also,
provinces are bigger.
And in the U.S., it is also state by state.
Yeah, it is.
Oh boy, is it ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a lot more of them, and there are far fewer provinces to worry about.
So the big takeaway, play to earn is folly, and if anybody pulls it off, it's going to cost them so much money.
There will be first movers in this market that will do it well. It's going to be expensive to do well.
I would say there are first movers in this space who are doing it, and some of them, I think, are at least attempting to do it well.
Yeah.
Great. Wow. Tyson Grattan from DLA Piper, Ryan Black from DLA Piper, Brandon Huffman from Odin Lawn Media. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have anything? Any final thoughts, Amanda?
No, I don't know.
No thoughts? Head empty?
I'm just thinking about turkeys now.
I'm thinking about possums.
All right. And with all of that wrapped, this has been GDC 2022 bonus episode number one. Thank you for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @VirtualEconCast. I'm at Amanda Farrow.
And I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
You can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconcast.com. We're also available on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Amazon, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, and more. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you would subscribe and, if possible, review the show. We'd love to know what you think.
You can DM us with questions, or you can send them to us via email at podcast@fsquared.biz. You can also join our Discord. Hit us up if you would like an invite to that. We will be back with a couple more bonus episodes from GDC. We will not have a news episode this weekend. It's been a fairly slow week, and we are still in the midst of college stuff for the eldest and getting the house set. So we're going to take another pause here. But this podcast, hopefully, you found informative and entertaining,
and it was a North American smorgasbord of legal information from the US and Canada, and so much fun.
Really, it was just a lot of Canada, which I was extremely here for. So we will see you next time, and remember to wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
See you soon.